Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review, dated Thursday, February 6, 2025. We'll start with an article headlined, Protesters Gather Outside Illinois Capitol, Call for Trump's Impeachment. By Jade Aubrey, Capital News, Illinois, Springfield. Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the Illinois State Capitol Wednesday to protest President Donald Trump's administration and Elon Musk. The group stood in the rain, holding signs and chanting phrases like, Dump Trump, Deport Elon, and No Trump, No KKK, No Fascist USA. The protest was announced in an Instagram post last week as part of the 50501 movement, which encouraged 50 protests in 50 states on the same day. Sky Murphy, one of the protesters, said the protest was against the executive order overreach and protecting our human rights in the Constitution. In the Instagram post, the event was described as a protest for freedom of speech, racial equality, women's rights, LGBTQ+ rights, public health and safety, gun violence, climate change, wealth equality. As part of the nationwide protests, the political activist group Political Revolution published a statement calling for immediate actions to rectify the injustices perpetrated by current leadership and to restore integrity and fairness to our political system. The statement included specific requests, such as a call for Trump's impeachment and investigations of government leaders, including Elon Musk, who Trump tapped to lead his newly created Department of Government Efficiency. The activist group also called for the reversal of executive orders that it believes infringe on citizen and human rights, for strengthening laws on hate speech, specifically Nazi propaganda or salutes, and reinstating diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. We won't stop until our goals are accomplished, Sky said. We're dedicated. Rain, sunshine, snow, ice, wind, we'll be here. Protesters said they heard about the event from posts on a variety of social media platforms, and there was no single organizer. They plan to hold future protests if their demands aren't met. This article is accompanied by a full-color photo attributed to Jade Aubrey, Capital News, Illinois. It shows protesters in front of the Capitol and is captioned, Protesters hold signs and chant in front of the Illinois State Capitol to protest President Donald Trump's administration on Wednesday, February 5th, 2025. Suspect arrested in Decatur homicide. Decatur. The Decatur suspect, wanted for the murder of 26-year-old Jamarcus T. Golden, was caught and arrested Wednesday, police said in a statement. Lieutenant Scott Rosenberry said defendant Timothy D. Chapman, 28, was found in Streeter by officers with the U.S. Marshals Service Great Lakes Regional Fugitive Task Force. Chapman was being held in the LaSalle County Jail, awaiting extradition to Decatur. Police found the mortally wounded Golden after responding to reports of a stabbing just after 4 a.m. January 30th in the 1200 block of North Church Street. Rosenberry said Golden had suffered multiple stab wounds and later died at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Rosenberry said the investigation into the killing is not over, however. The Decatur Police Department continues to investigate this homicide, he added. Anyone with information about this incident is encouraged to contact the Decatur Police Department's Criminal Investigations Division at 217-424-2734 or Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477. Man sentenced to life in Decatur double murder by Tony Reed, Decatur. Sentenced to stay in prison until he dies for fatally shooting two acquaintances, Raheem D. Davis greeted his life without parole sentence Wednesday with no emotion. The double murders in the early morning hours of July 21st, 2023, took the lives of Decatur men Carlondas Thomas, 19, and 30-year-old Andrell O'Neill in cold-blooded killings an eyewitness described as being without motive. Trayvon Brown Nelson, a third man present with the victims, and Davis in a car parked outside Davis's home in the 900 block of West View Street, had been allowed to live by the killer in a random act of mercy, made with the same capricious indifference with which Brown Nelson said the defendant had killed the other men. Brown Nelson testified at Davis's December jury trial at Macon County Circuit Court. He said they had all been sharing a drink together when Davis, 30, suddenly said he was going to get more alcohol. Instead, he came back with a handgun and opened fire, pumping multiple bullets into the victims. And when Thomas still showed some signs of life, the 26-year-old Brown Nelson described Davis as leaning back into the vehicle and shooting him again. "You're good. Take them to the hospital," the terrified witness had quoted Davis as telling him when he had finally stopped pulling the trigger. Family members had testified about their pain at Wednesday's sentencing hearing in several victim impact statements. Ashley Snell, the sister of Andrell O'Neill, quoted the words of her murdered brother's 5-year-old son, struggling to cope with the loss of his father. "He says, 'I want to go to heaven because I really miss my daddy,'" said Snell, 40. "This is like a bad dream we can't wake up from," she added, before later having to rush from the courtroom as the emotional strain became too much, and she could be heard sobbing outside in the corridor. Melinda Thomas, the 47-year-old mother of Carlondas Thomas, described the agony of losing a son as a dagger through the heart that never stops twisting. "I go to bed in pain, and I wake up in pain, asking God, 'Why am I still here?'" she said. "I had to sit and watch the casket close on my 19-year-old son, and the only way for him to come home with me was to be cremated." Davis did not visibly react as the statements were read and declined the opportunity to say anything in court. Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Christina Mullison said the family members had really said all that needed to be said, and the life without parole penalty decreed by law was the punishment Davis richly deserved. But defense attorney Lindsay Evans said her client, described as a snake and a monster by the victims' families, was a human being with a history of mental illness who deserved some mercy. She said the legal rules left presiding judge Thomas Griffith with no choice on sentencing, but the rules were still wrong. "We do believe that natural life with no opportunity for your honor to exercise any discretion is cruel and unusual and excessive punishment," she told the judge. Passing sentence, Griffith described the case as an agonizing tragedy where the life of the defendant would represent the third life lost. The defense plans to file a legal motion to challenge the sentence. Infamous Illinois murderers. Andre Crawford was convicted of killing 11 women in Chicago during a 6-year period in the 1990s. Authorities said at the time that Crawford targeted women who engaged in high-risk activities such as drug use and prostitution. He terrorized the Englewood and New City neighborhoods, two of the most impoverished and crime-ridden areas. His victims were Shagwanta Langley, Tommy Dennis, Sanji Brandon, Nicole Townsend, Evandre Harris, Cheryl Cross, Cheryl Johnson, Constance Bailey, Patricia Dunn, Rhonda King, and Angela Chatin. William Hirons, known as the Lipstick Killer because of a message left at the scene of one of the crimes, William Hirons pleaded guilty in 1946 to 3 gruesome murders, including the dismemberment of a 6-year-old girl. In a 19-page confession, Hirons admitted he stabbed Josephine Ross, 43, and stabbed and shot 32-year-old Francis Brown in 1945. He also admitted that he abducted and dismembered and killed Suzanne Degnan the following year. But in appearances before the state's parole board, Hirons said he was innocent. His attorney argued that the confessions were coerced and police mishandled the investigation. At the scene of Brown's murder, authorities found a message that would later become infamous written on the wall in lipstick. "For heaven's sakes, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." At the time of his death, Hirons, 83, was the state's longest-serving prisoner. Richard Speck. Richard Speck murdered 8 student nurses from South Chicago Community Hospital on the night of July 13th into the early morning hours of July 14th, 1966. His victims were Nina Jo Schmale, Patricia Ann Matusik, Pamela Lee Wilkening, Mary Ann Jordan, Suzanne Bridget Farris, Valentina Passion, Merlita Gargulo, and Gloria Jean Davy. Speck died in prison in 1991, a day before his 50th birthday. H.H. Holmes. Herman Webster Mudgett, also known as Dr. H.H. Holmes, may have been the country's first serial killer. Victims were lured into his personally designed mixed-use property, which later became known as a murder castle in 1890s Englewood. It's unclear how many people Holmes killed. While some accounts said he killed as many as 200, he was convicted of just one murder, that of business partner Benjamin Peitzel. Holmes confessed to killing 27 people, but some were still alive. Ripper Crew. The 4-person group known as the Ripper Crew is thought to be responsible for the slayings of as many as 17 women and for an unrelated fatal shooting of a man in the early 1980s. The group's sexually motivated crimes were so depraved that authorities compared their acts to a modern-day Jack the Ripper or Charles Manson. Members of the Ripper Crew were Robin Gecht, Edward Spreitzer, and brothers Andrew and Thomas Kokoriallis. Authorities said they stalked streets in Chicago and the west and northwest suburbs in a reddish-orange van in search of lone women to abduct. Raymond Lee Stewart. On January 27, 1981, at the age of 29, Raymond Lee Stewart began to carry out what Rockford authorities called the most violent 6 days in the city's history. The first victims were Willie Fred, 54, and his stock boy, Albert Pearson, 20, shot to death inside a grocery store on Rockford's west side. Victims Kevin Kaiser, 18, and Kenny Faust, 35, were service station attendants killed at gas stations. Richard Beck, 21, and Donald Raines, 26, were both found shot in the head inside a Radio Shack in Beloit, Wisconsin. Stewart was executed in 1996. Nicholas Troy Shelley. Nicholas Troy Shelley killed 8 people in Illinois and Missouri between June 23rd and 30th, 2008. His victims were Russell Reed, 93, of rural Sterling, Ronald Randall, 65, of Galesburg, Brock Branson, 29, his fiancée, Kelina Blake, 20, her 2-year-old son, Diane, and Kenneth Ulve, 25, all of Rock Falls, and Jill and Tom Estes, both 54, Arkansas residents killed in Festus, Missouri. He is currently incarcerated at Stateville Correctional Center, according to state records. Andrew Urdialis. Andrew Urdialis was convicted of murdering 8 women, 3 in Illinois and 8 in California. He was sentenced to death in 2002 in Cook County for the 1996 murders of Lori Yulaki, 25, of Hammond, Indiana, and Lynn Huber, 22, of Chicago. Their bodies were found in Wolf Lake near the Chicago-Hammond border. After then-Governor George Ryan commuted the sentences of all death row inmates, Urdialis was again sentenced to death in 2004 in the 1996 death of Cassie Corum, 21, of Hammond, Indiana. Her body was dumped in the Vermilion River in Pontiac, Illinois. After then-Governor Pat Quinn abolished the death penalty in Illinois in 2011, Erdialis was extradited to California, where he was convicted of in 2018 of the murders of five women, Robin Branley in Mission Viejo, Marianne Wells in San Diego, Julie McGee in Cathedral City, and Tammy Irwin and Denise Maney in Palm Springs. He was sentenced to death for those crimes in October 2018 and found death in an apparent suicide the following month in San Quentin Prison. Lorenzo Fain was convicted of killing five children and teenagers in the East St. Louis area between 1989 and 1993. He was found guilty of killing Ari Hunt, 6, Faith Davis, 17, Glenda Jones, 17, Fallon Flood, 9, and Latronda Dean, 14. Fain was sentenced to death, but his was among the death penalty sentences commuted by then-Governor George Ryan in 2003. In 2009, authorities said he was linked through DNA evidence to the 1989 murder of 32-year-old Rita Scott in Milwaukee. He is currently in Menard Correctional Center. Timothy Kretscher, sir, admitted to killing nine women in Missouri, Illinois, and Pennsylvania between 1977 and 1982. Imprisoned in 1983 for sexual offenses, Kretscher was connected to the murders after DNA evidence was analyzed decades later. He is currently held at Pontiac Correctional Center. Robert Ben Rhodes, known as the truck stop killer, has been convicted of three murders, one in Illinois, but is suspected of torturing, raping, and killing dozens more women between 1975 and 1990. He was sentenced to life in prison in 1994 for the murder of Regina Walters, a 14-year-old girl from Pasadena, Texas, whose body was found in Illinois. He also pleaded guilty in 2012 to the killings of Patricia Walsh, 24, and her husband, Douglas Scott Zykowski, 28, of Texas. Prosecutors said Rhodes kept a traveling torture chamber in the cab of his truck. It had handcuffs on the ceiling so that he could chain his victims before torturing and killing them. He is currently held in Menard Correctional Center. John Wayne Gacy was a serial killer who murdered more than 30 young men and boys. Gacy stabbed one victim and strangled the others between 1972 and 1978. He sometimes lured them to a Chicago-area home for sex by impersonating a police officer or promising them construction work. He buried 29 of his 33 victims in trenches underneath and around his home and dumped four others from bridges once his property could hold no more bodies. Gacy is remembered as one of history's most bizarre killers, largely because of his work as an amateur clown named Pogo. He was arrested in December 1978 at the age of 36 and was executed by lethal injection in 1994. Jury concludes sixth day of deliberations in Madigan corruption trial without verdict. By Jason Meisner, Megan Crapeau, and Ray Long, Chicago Tribune, Chicago. Jurors in the trial of Michael Madigan left the courthouse Wednesday, their sixth day of deliberations, without having reached a verdict and without having sent any notes or asked any questions. The complete radio silence was somewhat unusual. Jurors have sent at least one communication every day since they began their discussions the afternoon of January 29th. So far, they have deliberated for roughly 36 and a half hours. They're slated to return Thursday morning. The jury's deliberations kicked off the final phase of a landmark four-month trial. Their discussions have lasted longer than in two other recent high-profile corruption cases. The jury in the ComEd 4 bribery case, which featured evidence that overlapped significantly with some of the evidence in the Madigan trial, reached a verdict after about 27 hours. And jurors in the racketeering trial of former alderman Ed Burke found him guilty in about 23 hours. Jurors' only communication Tuesday was a note about scheduling, informing the judge that from now on they will break at 4:30 on most days instead of their initial 4:45 end time. That followed their Soul Note Monday, which asked about evidence related to Madigan's alleged scheme to put one-time political nemesis Juan Ochoa on the ComEd board. Madigan, who spent decades as the Speaker of the State House and ruled the Illinois Democratic Party with a tight grip, is charged with a racketeering indictment, accusing him of running his political and government operations like a criminal enterprise. Charged alongside him is Michael McLean, a former lobbyist who was Madigan's right-hand man. Last week, jurors' only communication was about scheduling and office supplies. Shortly before noon Thursday, they sent a note to the judge asking for more highlighters, sticky notes, and whiteout. Jurors have to consider 23 counts against Madigan, alleging an array of schemes to enrich his political allies and line his pockets. McLean is charged in 6 of those counts. To assist their deliberations, jurors have about 100 pages of legal instructions, dozens of undercover recordings, and hundreds of emails, texts, and other documents entered into evidence. Madigan, 82, of Chicago's Southwest Side, was for decades the most powerful man in Illinois politics, reigning over the state Democratic Party and setting a national record for longest-serving speaker of a state house. His co-defendant, Michael McLean, 77, is a retired lobbyist from downstate Quincy, who acted as Madigan's right-hand man. In addition to alleging plans to pressure developers into hiring Madigan's law firm, the indictment accuses Madigan and McLean of bribery schemes involving ComEd and AT&T in Illinois, where the utilities allegedly funneled payments through do-nothing subcontracts to a handful of the speaker's closest allies. Probation for Decatur gunman. Decatur. The Decatur man who pulled up next to a car driven by his ex-girlfriend's sister before opening fire at the driver multiple times has been sentenced to 24 months of probation. Adrian V. Wilson, 29, took a plea deal when he appeared January 28th in Macon County Circuit Court and admitted the reckless discharge of a firearm. The plea agreement, negotiated by defense attorney Mark Wyckoff, then saw presiding Judge Thomas Griffith dismiss 2 further charges alleging the aggravated discharge of a gun. The judge also dismissed a 4th charge accusing Wilson of the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. Once obscure Illinois company WeatherTech has wild ride with 13th Super Bowl ad by Robert Chenick, Chicago Tribune. Bolingbroke. When Super Bowl 59 airs Sunday on Fox from New Orleans, more than 100 million viewers are expected to watch the Kansas City Chiefs vie for an unprecedented three-peat when they take on the Philadelphia Eagles. An unlikely Chicago team is on an equally remarkable Super Bowl run, as WeatherTech, a once obscure Bolingbroke car floor mat manufacturer, and Pinnacle Advertising, a small Schaumburg agency, roll out their 13th Super Bowl commercial since 2014. That WeatherTech is still going head-to-head with some of the biggest brands in the world, a true David and Goliath marketing story, has defied skeptics and arguably changed the game of Super Bowl advertising. "It's really been astonishing," said Tim Calkins, a marketing professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, who heads up an annual Super Bowl advertising review. "I keep thinking it will be their last year. They keep showing up." In 2014, WeatherTech founder David McNeil had the audacity to blow a large chunk of his marketing budget on his first Super Bowl spot, paying $4 million for the airtime to compete on TV's biggest advertising stage. Employing the creative chops of little-known Northwestern suburban ad agency Pinnacle made WeatherTech even more of a long shot to succeed. Despite the naysayers, WeatherTech has become a Super Bowl mainstay over the years, joining the likes of Budweiser, Doritos, and T-Mobile. In the process, the privately owned company has grown exponentially, with annual sales in the high 9 figures and a ubiquitous year-round advertising presence. "The Super Bowl ads have truly elevated their brand," said Michael Magnuson, founder and CEO of Pinnacle Advertising. After a brief semi-hiatus, WeatherTech opted for a less expensive pre-game spot last year. The plucky Southwest Suburban Company is back in the big game with a second quarter commercial that cost a reported $7 million for the airtime. The new spot, which has been released in advance online, is a radical departure from WeatherTech's consistent Made in America messaging, shifting to a carload of 70-something women raising hell on the open road while keeping the interior pristine thanks to the floor mats. This might be their best spot so far, Calkin said. The Super Bowl remains the most expensive and most watched TV event of the year. A record 123.7 million viewers tuned into last year on CBS to see Kansas City beat San Francisco 25-22 in a memorable overtime contest from Las Vegas. Advertising for this year's broadcast was selling for a reported $7 million per spot in May, when WeatherTech and Pinnacle booked the airtime. The price has now climbed to a record $8 million per spot for a handful of last-second advertisers. Founded in 1989 by McNeil, WeatherTech makes custom vehicle floor mats, which it sells directly to consumers and to automobile makers. Over the years, it has expanded into everything from dog feeding systems and car phone holders to a brief foray into face shields during the pandemic. The company has more than 1,500 workers on its sprawling Bolingbrook campus where its products are made. WeatherTech's core marketing strategy has long been in the hands of Pinnacle, founded in 1998 by Magnuson, a former Chicago Tribune ad salesman. Started as a small auto industry-focused shop, Pinnacle made a name for itself with the first WeatherTech Super Bowl spot more than a decade ago. It has since grown to more than 100 employees, more than 100 clients across multiple industries, and more than $250 million in annual billings, with satellite locations in Scottsdale and San Francisco. The agency also survived a trademark infringement lawsuit with unrelated Pinnacle Advertising of Florida, whose existence came to light when trade publication Ad Age mistakenly linked to the wrong Pinnacle in an article about Super Bowl advertisers in January 25th, and then repeated the mistake in January 2016. The Florida agency has since gone out of business, Magnuson said. While declining to disclose the annual spend, Magnuson said WeatherTech remains Pinnacle's largest client, and that the company's advertising budget has grown in tandem with its annual revenue since taking the initial Super Bowl plunge. Taking a WeatherTech ad where no WeatherTech ad has gone before has also been fun and energizing for Pinnacle. While the spot features seniors, Magnuson said it should connect with a broader demographic. How it ultimately plays out will be decided Sunday, along with a football game between the Eagles and the Chiefs. We'll take a break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review dated Thursday, February 6th, 2025. Please stay tuned.